My name is Jeremy Triglow, and I'm talking this morning about Anna Karenina, which is one of four novels on your syllabus for this module, named after a central character, Madame Bovary, Young Werther, Jane Austen's Emma, and Anna Karenina. And that tradition of naming a novel after a character goes right back and continues. It continues later, for example, in Mrs. Dalloway and Lolita. You can trace it back to the 18th century, to Tom Jones and Tristram Shandy and Clarissa, back into the 17th to Orinoco, a novel of 1688 by Aphra Behn. And at least three of Shakespeare's great tragedies, if you think about it, are named after their central character: Hamlet, King Lear, Othello. If you go back into classical Greek tragedy, you find a preponderance of such titles: Agamemnon, Antigone, Oedipus, Electra, Alcestis, Medea. So obviously these titles are stressing something about the importance of an individual, and not just the specific individual named, but the idea of individuality, the importance of the concept of an individual, or an individualist in some cases. And one way or another, what almost all fiction does is to explore what it feels like to be an individual, or a number of individuals, depends on the novel, within a society, within a family, within a cosmos, and especially at odds with any of those groups. What's less obvious is why Anna Karenina is called Anna Karenina, why the focus is so strongly on her in the title. It's a tragedy of doomed love, the novel, and many such tragedies have had the names of both main characters, both lovers, Troilus and Cressida in both Chaucer's and Shakespeare's versions, Hero and Leander, Marlowe's poem, Venus and Adonis, another poem by Shakespeare, Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, Antony and Cleopatra, go on, Tristan and Isolde. You can come up with these pairings yourself. But if you thought about calling this novel Anna and Vronsky, there'd be something wrong. And I want to try and think a little bit about why. What would be wrong about calling it Anna and Vronsky? What else it might be called? And I've sought help from some movie versions, because often adaptations of great works tell you as much as criticism about them. They are a work of criticism in themselves. They're a work of interpretation by another imaginative artist or group of imaginative artists seeking to communicate the essence of a work to a new audience and a new kind of audience. There have been many, many films, stage adaptations, TV series based on this particular novel. And even if what they're telling you is sort of by default, by what they don't do, that in itself can be helpful. To me, Joe Knight's direction of the current movie, the one starring Keira Knightley and Jude Law, is purposelessly tricky and artificial. But there are good things about it, which I'll come on to. It's sort of Baz Luhrmann out of Derek Jarman. But the script by Tom Stoppard is, I don't know, how many of you have seen it, by the way? Good. The script by Tom Stoppard is really pretty faithful to the original, although it has got sort of a somewhat reduced Shakespeare Company element of condensation that can be risible at times. It is very faithful to the novel. I want to focus first, though, on a very early version made in 1935. In which Greta Garbo played Anna. Garbo had made her name in silent movies, and so the first talking films she made were ones which in which the actual words she used were particularly focused on and became catchphrases, particularly I Want to Be Alone in Grand Hotel, 1932, which became a sort of catchphrase for Garbo herself, who was a reclusive person. That film won an Oscar for Best Picture, and I think there may have been some attempt to capitalize on it in the emphasis on Anna's interest in loneliness and being alone in this 1935 production that had a script by Clements Dane. Anna tells Vronsky, "We came here to be alone." At another point, she says, "One day I shall find myself alone." Whether it's really true of Tolstoy's Anna that she wants to be alone is something that I'll touch on briefly later. Certainly it's not what his novel is about. It's about gregariousness, sociability, family, socialization, how people find themselves enabled to live with each other. And as an extension of that, it's about good government, how the world should be organized, a world which is full of people, not just Anna Karenina. We see the operations of society with a big S in that ball scene early on, the Shabatsky's ball, with its role in relation to semi-arranged marriages. We see the complex human negotiations that are involved in Karenin's world of politics, which I'll come back to. And of all forms of human grouping, the family is the one, I would say, that the novel stresses most. The first words of the novel, very famous first words, are about families. All happy families are alike, it says. But an unhappy family is unhappy after its own fashion. Fantastically powerful hook at the beginning of the novel that makes you immediately want to read on. And we are thrown straight away into the effects on individuals, particularly on Dolly, of Oblonsky's problems in settling for married life as a complete and adequate version of what he himself needs. When Oblonsky's financial recklessness, as distinct from his sexual recklessness, brings the family into debt, it's family that comes into play to help solve the problem. Kitty, you remember, Levin suggests to Kitty that she might, since they've got plenty of land and money, hand over some of her inheritance to Dolly as a way of enabling Dolly to sell the woods that they need to sell to meet Oblonsky's debts without actually herself becoming resourceless. Kitty herself sees it as a natural reflex, not just a duty, to help her husband's brother, Nikolai, when he's dying. And Anna's downward trajectory is balanced by Levin's opposite one, from a sort of awkward solitude, an unease with other people, to family happiness and happiness as the head of an extended family of estate workers and servants. If the book is going to be named after any one person, it surely Levin has as strong a claim as Anna. Now, some of these aspects of the book, which are neglected in the quite short film that stars Greta Garbo, it's 90 minutes long, are brought out more in another of the early film treatments, longer, in fact, 140-minute version produced by Alexander Korda after the Second World War, directed by Jean Duvivier. I've given you the details on the handout, with a script credited to the dramatist Jean Anouilh. The costumes are by Cecil Beaton, the music by Constant Lambert. These were the people absolutely at the peak of their creative and professional powers at that time. There's a sort of underlying Cold War agenda, I think, in this 1948 production, in that it's glamorizing exactly the qualities of pre-revolutionary Russian life that had been, it might be said, thrown away by communism. But more than that, it's an ample, intelligent rendition of the novel, and it's mainly true to its words and incorporates many of its structural elements, although, again, a lot's missing. In both films that I've mentioned, there's a lot missing in relation to Anna's pregnancy. It's left out altogether from the Garbo version, 1935, and the 1948 one, she loses the baby at birth. So a key part of her dilemma in human terms is reduced in these films to a decision between her son and Vronsky. Her inability to form a bond with her daughter is left out, And the relationship with Seryozha, the son, is sentimentalized in both films. The novel, on the other hand, is explicit about the fact that, because it's explicit about every degree of complication, every moment where people's impulses go in the opposite direction of what seems to be their dominant trend. It stresses, or at least it's explicit about the fact, that her disaffection with her marriage can even affect her feelings for her son. When she comes back early from Moscow, she's looking forward to seeing her son, but actually he disappoints her slightly. The novel says, in imagination, while she was away, she had pictured Seryozha nicer than he actually was. It's a very important and telling little moment, and there's nothing of that in the films. It's one of the ways in which the book's very fierce and clear psychological observation complicates our sympathies. Another element the films omit is the novel's omniscience about what everybody thinks and feels about each other. We can see it in the acting very often, but we don't get the elaborate, almost diagnostic discussion of how X sees Y and reacts to Z at particular moments that you get in the novel. Least of all can we get in a film very much about what a character in the novel thinks in terms of an articulated and complex philosophy. This is a philosophical novel in which people are discussing how one should live, how one can live, how the world should be organized. And once again, I want to stress that I think this is a very important element in relation to Karenin, who is involved in government. He's a high government official. The film versions that I've seen are not kind to Karenin. In 1935, he was played by Basil Rathbone, who was then in his 40s, and he was fast building a career as a screen villain, a suave villain. He's Mr. Murdstone in David Copperfield. He plays Pontius Pilate in The Last Days of Pompeii. Both of those films were in the same year as Anna Karenina. And here he is. This may take me just a moment to mobilize. Here he is meeting Anna off the train. I'm just going to reduce the lights a bit and go back to the main page. And I've selected that, so I hope it'll work. Don't seem to have any sound. Garbo, Spronsky. Okay, I'll in a moment, just for the sake of comparison, show you a different version in which Karenin, this is the 1948 version, Karenin is played by Ralph Richardson, a much more complex account than the one Basil Rathbone gives, and especially in the crucial area of the book where Anna has puerperal fever and in this version loses her baby. Vivian Lee, who plays Anna in the 1948 film, had become world famous in Gone with the Wind and was a subject of endless public scrutiny. Although there were no social media in those days, in our sense of the world, of the word, there were plenty of gossip magazines and movie magazines. And people knew that she was in a tempestuous marriage to Laurence Olivier, who was known to be a domineering character, that she had what we would now call bipolar disorder, and that she had had a miscarriage. So some of this extraneous information about Vivian Lee will have been in people's minds a bit when they thought about that episode of the film. Now, I'm going to have to pause for a moment while I eject this, which I think I do down here, and put the other one in. I'm trying to eject it. Yeah. Okay. So this is just for the sake of comparison, the same episode, I hope. Oh God. Sorry. Have to run through that again. Okay. There's Ralph Richardson, and you see immediately that he's surrounded by people looking after him. It's very hard for people to be alone in this version of Anna Karenina. There are always servants, officials, family, friends. There's Vronsky, same hat. Vivian Lee. Rather threatening advance by this little troop.
You are a kind, devoted husband you have, just as in the old days, burning with desire to see you, my dear. Want to wear a
knife? Hi, Debbie.
You know, all the water I came to my room. Quite well. I didn't have to see you. Is it a cat? Did you have a good night, my
dear? Yes, thank you. Very good. Can't
I believe I have the honor of your acquaintance. It seems, my dear, you went with the mother and came back with the son. You're back from leave, no doubt. I hope to have the honor of calling you. Delighted we receive on Thursday. I was very lucky to be able to come. I'm still under the program.
Now, if you look at the text of that episode, which is on the first page of the handout at the bottom, You'll see that one of the things that the novel is able to do but the film can't is to present character as perceived by another character. Very importantly, when we first meet Karenin in the novel, it's through Vronsky's eyes. There he is thinking about seeing Anna again. And then, before he caught sight of her, this is on the left-hand column, he saw her husband, whom the station master was deferentially escorting through the crowd. Ah, yes, the husband. And then everything we learn about Vronsky at first is from Karenin's, from Vronsky's perception of him, how he sees him. And then we move out a bit, we have a bit of dialogue, but again, this time we're seeing the situation as seen by Anna. She turned to her husband, this is on the right-hand column, to find out whether he knew Vronsky. Karenin looked at him with displeasure, vaguely recalling who this was. Vronsky's composure and self-confidence thrust like a scythe on stone upon the cold self-confidence of Karenin. Count Vronsky, said Anna, ah, we have met before, I believe, said Karenin indifferently. See how it's moving a bit between a kind of omniscient perception of the character and what Anna sees of him in reaction to Vronsky. Now, this is all part of the perceptual density that the naturalist novel brings to its limit, and particularly in the work of Tolstoy. The contention, if you like, between different subjectivisms, different individuals, how even at the most minute level, everything they see, everything they are, is affected by the other people around them. George Eliot, at the end of Middlemarch, calls this equivalent centers of self. And part of what her novel is about is those who can and can't adjust to the fact that they aren't the only person in the world and that other people may have equally strong claims on attention and respect, among other things, affection. This is complicated even further by Tolstoy in his overwhelming consciousness, overwhelming to the reader, that the self changes, that the selves that are in, that are dealing with each other, are never quite in the same place as they're expected to be. They're mobile and they're unpredictable. Anna finds Karenin exasperating and confining, but she also values him. She has loved him, and indeed, the novel makes clear at times she still does love him. They get home, she sees her son, Karenin goes to the office and returns, he talks about developments at work. And then on page two, the second quotation, she says, God bless you, at the door of the study. Religion is another matter we're going to need to refer to in a moment. He pressed her hand and kissed it again. After all, he's a good man, upright, kind, and remarkable in his own line, Anna said to herself when she had returned to her room, as though defending him from attack. Whose attack is she defending him from? Hers? Vronsky's? The world's? Defending him from the accusation that he was not lovable. It's her that's doing that. But why, she says, is it his ears stick out so oddly? Or has he had his hair cut too short? That the way in which the hugely important and the seemingly trivial are juxtaposed to is very characteristic of and important to this novel. Now, if Anna is inconsistent, so Karenin is too. His efforts to be good. He wants to be a good at his work, a good husband, a good father, an affectionate person. I think Richardson gets all that very well in his rendering of the role. But in his efforts to be a good husband, he's got to contend with this competition from Vronsky, with jealousy, which he says he doesn't, he thinks jealousy is a despicable emotion. He's not going to let himself be affected by it. But the fact that he says that doesn't mean that he's capable of not being affected by it. We don't have to take what he says at face value. And, of course, his feelings and his behavior swing again when Anna seems to be dying and begs for his forgiveness, and he forgives her. And indeed, in a moment that his contemporaries and friends think is absurd, he forgives Vronsky. That comes out very powerfully in the Stoppard version, the current movie, I think. But then when Anna doesn't keep to the deal that he's offered her, he then swings against her again. So change in people's behavior, change often against what they want for themselves and what they know is best, is very important. And it has implications for how we think about how a society can be run. It's not just how we get on with each other at home or in our immediate social circle, but if you're thinking about millions of people in a society, and they're all as changeable and all as impelled by contrary feelings and wishes, how do you keep that show on the road? I just want to see if I can find a bit, if you'd be patient with me, from the middle of another scene in the Rafe Richardson version. Let's just stop. I want the disk menu if I can. Scene selection. Brilliant. I can't quite see what's being highlighted, but I want next. Have I got next? No? Bam, back to one. Okay. Yeah. Have I got six? No. Where am I? Can anybody see where I am? I'm on next. I don't want to be there. I want to be. Where am I now? How do I get to six? Is anything highlighted now?
No. Still next.
I can't even see next on this. Oh, it's over there. Yeah, I see it. Bloody hell. It's not doing anything, is it? Well, we're going to have to forego that treat, I think, because it's just too complicated. Sorry about that. The two main points I've been trying to focus on so far have been that Anna Karenina is not solely about Anna, and that its presentation of a range of people trying to find ways of living together is essential to its political philosophy. But for the moment, I think it's worth mentioning that the issue of change, the fact that character is not fixed, behavior not consistent, that, as biologists have subsequently proved, our very physical composition is different from day to day and year to year. All this can usefully be connected to Tolstoy's career more generally, both as a novelist and as a human being, someone who had huge influence on how other human beings thought and behaved, an influence which, for example, in political movements which employ passive resistance, continues today. Anna Karenina was published, and I've given you these dates on the handout, in 1877, that's 8 years after War and Peace. It was first published in English translation in 86, and again more influentially by Constance Garnett in 1901. There are many different translations of the book. I've used the Rosemary Edmonds one, which was a Penguin classic, and which I think is particularly good, though I'm not a Russianist, and so you have to discount what I'm saying to that degree. I haven't read the book in Russian. Tolstoy had already written autobiographical novels, a trilogy, Childhood, Boyhood, and Youth. So it's clear that the material of his own life was regarded by him as legitimate material for fiction. I don't want to talk about the novel in biographical terms, but Tolstoy himself knew that what he had experienced was bound to find its way into his work. We need to rely for that a bit. He'd written about family and about happiness in a novella called Family Happiness in 1859, which turns out to be quite the opposite of happiness. And I'll suggest that there is perhaps no writer who has been more able to communicate not only unhappiness, which is a theme so many writers deal with, but happiness. He communicates elation, joy, steady happiness exceptionally well, against the cliche that it's often said that you can't write about happiness. Montelnon said, happiness writes white. There's nothing there. In his own life, Tolstoy himself experienced immense change. I don't just mean in the world around him, which we could talk about historically, but in his own beliefs and circumstances. He started out in a prosperous, aristocratic, old nobility family, money, land, serfs. He married very young, having experienced warfare. He was in the army for a bit. Before that, he was a student for a bit, and his tutors said he was unteachable. He was just not interested in obedience or respect or, you know, sitting down and doing boring hard work. So he traveled, he was in the army, he built up huge gambling debts. Some of this all finds its way into his work. He read immensely, particularly in French and German fiction, but also theology and philosophy. And all that contributed to massive convulsions in his thinking. He rejected feudalism. He rejected social inequality. He rejected centralized government and militarism. He was an early anarchist in the full and technical sense of the word anarchist. He was an active social reformer. He founded schools for the children of serfs. He came to believe that there should be no such thing as private property and that there should be no such institution as marriage. But he was married. In his mid-30s, he married a girl who was still in her teens. And they had 13 children, three of whom died when they were babies. Those three in succession, so they were the middle three of the 13, and those deaths occurred at the time that he was writing Anna Karenina. Now, like the novel he was writing, Tolstoy himself had, as a writer, an immense afterlife. I think there is no novelist about whom other novelists have been closer to unanimity in regarding him as the great writer. Flaubert, Chekhov, Joyce, Virginia Woolf, Thomas Mann, Faulkner, Nabokov, they all saw Tolstoy's fiction, and particularly Anna Karenina, as supreme. Yet Tolstoy himself later thought that it had little value. He'd written these immense novels, but he thought life and politics and getting the world into a better shape was more important, and that these novels were essentially not exactly a waste of time, but that he could have been using his time better. It's not, I think, frivolous to point out that if a great artist writes a work which is a great deal about changeability and then changes his mind about whether it was worth doing in the first place, we have a little bit of a philosophical problem if we ourselves admire the work. Certainly a paradoxical situation to be in. And the novel itself attends to paradoxes like this in various ways, and particularly in ways for which few of the films I've seen have found room. One is religious, and the other is political. Karenin and Levin both care about both, and in different ways. Karenin's Christianity is a set of rules and aspirations which he tries hard to live up to. Levin's Christianity was similarly acquired as part of his Russian Orthodox background, but he knows it to be irrational. You can't prove that this stuff is true. At the same time, he feels drawn to it, and throughout the novel is struggling between whether he believes in it or not, whether at some level it's true beyond reason. And of course, it returns to him, his religious belief, at the end of the novel, in a moment, a sort of conversion experience. One which in the film, the recent film, he movingly can't speak about to Kitty. She says, "So what happened?" He says something really fantastic happened, remember, and she's dealing with the baby, and then after a bit she says, well, what was it that happened? And he said, no, nothing. Now, if you're thinking about the novel as a novel about change, among other things, again, you're left in a paradoxical situation as an interpreter at the end, aren't you? Because the end of a novel is where we traditionally think everything has been wrapped up and resolved. But Levin has had so many different changes of mood and belief through the course of the novel that there's no real reason to think that this one at the end is going to be lasting. It's powerful. The novel stops there. We don't know. But our not knowing is an important aspect of the effect of the novel, the ambiguity that it leaves us with. The same is true of the politics of some of the characters in the book. Men, it's that the women don't get involved in politics, and the gender politics of the book are something you'll want to think about, I'm sure, in your seminars. They've been much written about, and the issues will be clear enough to you, I think. So I'm not going to talk about them now. But I think that the government issue is less attended to, and that's why I want to focus on it. Politics, as I've been trying to say, it's obvious, but it needs to be said, has to deal with the many. For the 17th century English philosopher, political philosopher Hobbes, it was how to move from what he called the multitude, which was a term that Machiavelli also used, to a people. How you make a multitude of self-willed, potentially homicidal individuals, quarrelsome, into a productive and harmonious body, a people. And that concern was also shared by a contemporary of Hobbes called Baruch Spinoza, a Dutch Jewish philosopher from whom I've given you a short quotation on the handout. This is from his last work, which was unfinished, is known as Political Treatise. He says, in laying political foundations, it is very necessary to consider the human passions. And it's not enough to have shown what ought to be done, but it ought above all to be shown how it can be affected that men, whether led by passion or reason, should yet keep the laws firm and unbroken. Now, much of that could be a sort of manifesto for Tolstoy's fiction, and indeed Tolstoy read Spinoza and referred to him very often. He doesn't follow Spinoza to his conclusion, which is that the best system of government is a benign monarchy, but certainly Levin ends up on a small scale being a kind of benign monarch on his lands and with his serfs and family. Levin himself has tried different kinds of active involvement in government. At the beginning of the novel, he served on a Zemst, which is a form of local authority, local government that had been instituted quite recently by the liberal Tsar, Alexander II, but he's disillusioned by the experience. And we see Levin over and over again in situations where people are doing politics and involving trading favors with each other, being social with each other, being hypocritical with each other in order to achieve particular ends that are of themselves good, and not getting it. You just can't be bothered with it. But that's the art, of course, that Karenin supremely has and which has caused him to rise. And there are various different forms of political engagement and thinking that go on in the novel. Koznishev, the half-brother of Nikolai and Levin, is himself a philosopher famous throughout Russia, it's said. That's right at the beginning. His abstract thinking, the abstractedness of it, exasperates Levin. Levin thinks, well, he's just about to get to the point, and then he's off on some elaborate theory that is irrelevant. But it's not irrelevant. One of the things that Koznishev is interested in is disputing current beliefs that psychological and physiological phenomena are one and the same thing, the mind-body question. And if you think about it, this is another central question engaged with by the novel. It begins with the psychological effects on Dolly of the physical appetites of her husband. When Kitty is rejected by Vronsky, she's 18, she develops anorexia. There's the alcoholism of Levin's brother Nikolai. And there's the fact that Anna's behavior is increasingly affected by morphine addiction. That's omitted altogether from the two earlier film versions, but it is brought in a bit in the film version that many of you have seen. Though I think not stressed quite enough, it's when she has puerperal fever in the novel that she's prescribed morphine. Subsequently, she takes it to alleviate symptoms, but then not exactly recreationally, but just to make herself feel better, and it produces erratic forms of behavior in her. So that the mind-body question is central to Anna's deterioration, if one wants to put it that way, simplistically for the moment. And the mind-body question is also, of course, related to the issue of free will, and with that of responsibility. How free are we to decide what we do? We see plenty of examples of people wanting to behave well and actually behaving badly in this novel, Anna and Karenin both. But there are much more complicated issues involved here. These are simple points, and knows that she shouldn't have taken Vronsky off Kitty at the ball, but she couldn't help herself. When she asks Vronsky why he's come on the train pursuing her, she leaves Moscow because she wants to end this. She wants to behave properly. She leaves and he follows her. She says, "Why did you follow me?" He says, "I can't help myself." And there are many little tiny examples of this. So, for example, in that scene when her husband meets her at the station, the novel tells us that she involuntarily listens for Vronsky's footsteps behind her. Involuntarily, specific. In other words, she doesn't mean to. She can't stop herself. She's doing it. And involuntary behavior and its consequences crops up at trivial but important levels at many points, particularly Vronsky's Karenin's cracking his thumbs, which exasperates her. But is it his fault that he cracks his thumbs? Are we to blame him? I think that, can we blame Anna for minding? Responsibility could be the title of the novel, it seems to me. You might want to discuss that. What would be lost and gained by retitling the novel Responsibility? And the character who has most power and most responsibility is Karenin, whose areas of government include the province of Zaraisky, 100 miles southeast of Moscow. And there are two big issues being dealt with in Zaraisky: irrigation for growing food, and the indigenous tribes, who in the film are briefly mentioned as gypsies and Jews, and sort of to bring the issue alive and to make us see the importance of it. Increasing urbanization and the Europeanized character of the middle and upper middle class in Moscow and in the surrounding areas was coming into conflict with indigenous groups, some of which were nomadic. And of course, as soon as you have a culture of settlement, of private property, which is one of the big issues that concern Tolstoy and which comes out in the novel, as soon as you have private property, you want to say to these migrant groups, get off my land. But the migrant groups who've gone away with their sheep to pasture and then come back to another pasture naturally say, well, this is my land. We've always, my tribe, grazed our sheep here. What are you doing putting a fence around it? So these issues that Karenin is dealing with, and it's very tempting to skip. We all know that, you know, we get to these political bits in Anna Karenina and we think, oh, you know, but actually this is what the novel is about. It's not just about, you know, Anna sprawled out in a star shape on a bed under a camera pointing down vertically with Vronsky, like in that trashy scene, cliched scene of the recent movie. And it's very important that Tolstoy is determined to make us see that Karenin's job is important, that he's dealing with important issues. He says, it's in the handout, the text says, Karenin's character, this is in my text on page 307, I think I've put it on the handout. Karenin's characteristic quality as a statesman, the qualification, that special individual qualification that every rising functionary has, the qualification that with his unflagging ambition, his reserve, his probity, and his self-confidence had made his career, was his contempt for red tape, his cutting down of correspondence, his direct contact, wherever possible, with the root of the matter in hand, and his economy. And nothing bad about any of that, is there? I mean, this is somebody who not only wants to do the job, a job that is of supreme importance, whether people have got water to grow food, whether people are able to live with their neighbors, but he does it well. The breakdown of his marriage prevents him from doing it well. He starts to do it badly. So these things are totally interconnected in the novel. Well, how do the issues that I'm talking about, the political issues, impinge on Anna, the character who, after all, the novel is named after? I'm going to run through a few things extremely quickly because the time is running out. First of all, one of the novel's socio-political themes is inequality and between genders as well as classes. One of the causes of Anna's loneliness before she meets Vronsky is her husband's absorption in his work. She knows it's important work, and she knows he's trying hard not to leave her out of it. And he tries to take an interest in the things that interest her, but it doesn't work. She actually hates being alone, unlike Garbo's Anna. She's happiest when she's surrounded by people, by family, by lovers, by social life. She's most unhappy when she's ostracized by society, and when her husband isn't there, when Vronsky isn't there. She starts to go nuts when Vronsky isn't there, when she expects him to be. Secondly, among the ways in which this world has been governed, arranged marriages have had a role, which, as we gather from the reflections of Princess Shabatsky before the ball, is undergoing a rocky transition. She says, okay, we know now we can't do things, she thinks, Princess Shabatsky thinks, we can't do things like we used to, arranging marriages. But nobody is telling us how we should do them. What are we supposed to do to make sure that marriage, this in the novel, tremendously important institution, prospers. Thirdly, a related matter to that, of course, is divorce, and particularly the rules about custody of children and the authority of husbands. One of the problems for Vronsky is that his daughter, by Anna, can't take his name. She takes Anna's husband's name. Fourth, while Anna is the center of her own life, like her brother is of his, of Vronsky. The novel uses this solipsism, this self-absorption, to stress that people must learn to share the world with each other through generosity, through love, through responsibility, through good government. And it does this in all the ways I've mentioned, but there are just two more. On Anna's final journey, she's for the first time aware in her psychological state, hyper-aware of how many people beyond herself there are in the world, people she doesn't know anything about. I've put some quotations together at the bottom of the second page of the handout. Two girls passed, laughing. I wonder what they can be smiling at, she thought. Three boys running about playing at horses. What can that man be telling the other with such ardor, she thought, glancing at two passers-by. Can one ever tell anyone what one is feeling? There goes someone satisfied with himself, she thought, seeing a portly-faced gentleman driving past in the opposite direction. Those two boys want some of that filthy ice cream. I don't know these streets at all. How hilly it is. At houses and houses, everywhere. And in the house is people, and more people. There couldn't be a more poignant, though fragmented, awareness of the limits of her own importance as an individual. And the sheer number of people being capable of being considered is what occupies the end of the novel, which, like Madame Bovary, does not end with the heroine's death. But it does more than Madame Bovary in this respect. Madame Bovary, you remember, ends with a famous irrelevancy, but everything that happens in the pages after Emma's death is to do with how her death impacts on other people, and particularly on Charles. She still, in other words, dominates the narrative, and Flaubert makes that explicit, that she's controlling Charles from beyond the grave. And the opposite is true of Anna. If you look at those many pages, 50 or more pages after her death, we turn back straight away after her death to that relatively minor character, Levin's philosopher brother, Koznishev, who's interested in the mind-body question. Then we go to Russia's anti-Islamic war in Serbia, the fact that Vronsky is going to raise a cavalry, has raised a cavalry brigade to go there. We assume he'll die, but we don't hear anything about that. Then the remaining 50 pages are mainly about the Levin family, Kitty's baby, the harvest, sowing, and Levin's conversion experience. And in all this, Anna is not mentioned, not mentioned. It's as if she never existed. We just hear people vaguely thinking, yeah, it's quite right that Vronsky's gone off to the Serbian war. And the right Stoppard movie, I think, is beautifully true to all that. I began by talking about that famous opening of Anna Karenina, about happiness and unhappiness. But what I want from a reading of the novel, whether a critical reading in the form of literary criticism or a movie or a stage adaptation, is a sense of happiness as emerging from ordinariness. And in particular, I think it won't do to inflate the glamour and beauty and centrality of Anna, or to, in the cause of inflating it, to downgrade Karenin. I would love to see a Karenin, and Jude Law is okay as Karenin, isn't he? But he's not, you know, you don't think, oh yeah, now I understand Karenin for the first time. I would like a Karenin who is decent and ordinary and hardworking and obsessively professional, but not unattractive, and a relationship which carries all the complexities of that. I think it'd be quite interesting to see Karenin, if you're any budding movie directors here, played by David Morrissey, for example. Okay, thanks very much.